Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, engineer, and artist, Carmen Rizzo. But first, let's talk about Chicago's new cloud tax. Yes, there's a tax for listening to music or getting any type of entertainment from the cloud. This has been kind of like the holy grail for governments everywhere. They want to line their coffers with the new revenue source, and that's going to come from you using the internet in order to get your entertainment. So in other words, if you pay $100 a year for Spotify, there's a 9% tax for listening to it if you live in Chicago, which will now cost you $109. So this is a drag, and it opens up the door for taxes, local taxes, just about everywhere, and we might even see a federal tax, except for the fact there are a number of attorneys that look at this and they say, wait, this is illegal in a number of ways. The first one is they claim it violates the Federal Communications Act, and the other way is it violates the Tax Freedom Act. So in other words, it looks like Chicago is going to have their hands full trying to enforce this, but already it's gone into effect, and ISPs in the Chicago area are now collecting the tax. And they're not happy about it either, because it's increased bookkeeping for them, and they also have a number of Chicagoland customers that aren't very happy with them for collecting it. So I think what you'll start to see is ISPs in the Chicagoland area move outside the city limits if they can. And you'll also see a number of attorneys and a number of class action suits being instituted as soon as possible on this. But it's an ominous sign if Chicago should win this, because it opens up the door for more and more taxes on your internet consumption, and that's not a good thing. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is something else that's sort of ominous, and that's PV introduced a new line of mixers that has auto-tune installed in them as a standard feature. Yes, now we have a mixer with auto-tune built in. This is the PV AT series, and it's actually an entry-level mixer, so it's anywhere from 6 to 12 inputs. So it's not aimed at people that are doing concert level or even big club level venues. This is aimed at musicians that are just starting in music and just starting to play in bands. It's not a good precedent. For one thing, what it does is it encourages people not to rehearse, not to practice, because if you can have a tool that will fix your out-of-tuneness, your vocal out-of-tuneness, that's the one thing, of course, that many singers have. They have that problem when they're singing live. You can sound great singing by yourself. You can sound great under the controlled conditions of the studio. But of course, singing live with the band is a different story. And one of the marks of a really good singer is being able to overcome a bad monitor mix, being able to overcome just about anything and still sing in tune. And of course, having auto-tune built in really discourages that. So this is a drag on many levels. Auto-tune obviously doesn't sound very good when it's set on automatic. And as many of you who use auto-tune frequently know, what you really have to do is use it with discretion. So you go in and you find some notes that really need it and use it only on those. You don't use it across the whole mix, or the whole vocal, if you can help it. And most of the time, you can find just a few notes that really need some help in order to fit into the mix. Many times, some slight out-of-tuneness in the mix actually gives it a feel and isn't so bad that you have to go in and fix it. So you find that most mixers will use it with discretion. And of course, when you have it built into a product, you find that if you set it on automatic, you use it all the time, and boy, there are some bad artifacts besides the fact that you're using it as a crutch. I understand why PV did it. I understand why Antares licensed Auto-Tune, because obviously they want to make money and there is probably a demand for it. So I understand why this would happen, but boy, it's not a good idea. And I encourage anyone who buys one of these mixers, if you're listening, to turn it off because it's not a feature that you really want to use. Use the time to get better at what you do, practice a little more, and you won't need it at all. My guest today is the multi-talented producer, engineer, and artist, Carmen Rizzo. He's worked with everyone from Seal to Coldplay to Pete Townsend to Paul Oakenfold, just to name a few. Carmen is also one of the few engineer producers who's made the transition to being an artist, with 5 successful albums and a number of film scores under his belt. Carmen now heads artist relations for Native Instruments as well. I spoke with him via Skype from his home in Los Angeles. You grew up in Akron, right?
Well, it's interesting. I was born in Akron, and then I was raised in Connecticut as a child, because I only lived in Akron for 2 years. And then I moved to the East Bay in San Francisco, where I went to school and was pretty much raised there. But I moved to Los Angeles when I was 19. So I've really been here most of my life.
How did you get started in the music business? Were you a player first?
Yeah, my story, I'll make it short. My story was I was fortunate to be a gifted drummer as a child, and was making all kinds of bands and awards, and was just fortunate that it came pretty natural to me. And my mother was a music teacher. She was the school music teacher. She was the piano teacher, the church organist, et cetera. So I was always around music. But then at a certain point, I wanted to be a pro baseball player.
Yeah.
And I really played baseball. It was like baseball and music was my whole life growing up. And then I was like, I want to devote more to baseball, which I went pretty far. I went to this American Legion League, and my coach was a scout for the Phillies. But when I made that team at around 18, I thought I was good. But as you know, sports, you get to a level and like everybody's good.
Yeah, yeah.
That was when I knew, okay, my baseball career is over. I'm going to have fun with baseball. And then I went back to music. So my story to go back to music was then at 19, I went to a recording school up in San Francisco, and I was the least likely to succeed. Like, I really didn't know anything. Because, I mean, technically, like to be an engineer and a producer, and I was a stagehand at the Concord Pavilion, which is an amphitheater up there. And then I was like, screw this, I'm moving to Los Angeles. So I showed up in 1984. I had $1,000. I lived with my sister and her husband in Orange County. And then I ended up getting a job at Westlake Studios, where I was the janitor in the morning, then I was the runner during the day, and then I would sleep at the studio often at night or hang out as late as I could just to learn. And that's kind of how I got in.
That's cool. I mean, but you know, so many people have started that way. The only difference many people start that way, but they don't get beyond that, or they don't get beyond being an assistant. And you went way far beyond that.
Yeah, I think I was fortunate that I kind of tried to make opportunity for me. And I think I always tell that to young people, that you can't just sit and wait for the phone to ring. You can't, like, especially if you're schooled. Because back then, it didn't really matter if you were schooled. They didn't have programs to place people. You know, if you didn't learn on a big console, you weren't going to learn. Or tape machines, which, as you know, these things are just too expensive to have back then. So I was, you know, fortunate to kind of make some opportunities for myself, be at the right place at the right time. And then I think where I got my real big break, because I didn't assist very long, was that I used technology as my crutch to move forward. And what I mean by that is I gravitated to technology back then, like early sampling and early digital keyboards, digital technology, like euphonics and things. And then I ended up working for a guy named John Barnes, because I assisted around town, like Westlake and Motown and a couple of rooms but just for a couple of years, maybe 3-4 years. And then John Barnes, who I don't know if you know who he is, but he was a pretty successful session player in the 80s, and he was very into technology. So he had one of the first Synclaviers and Fairlights and digital tape machines and samplers, et cetera. And so I learned that, and he knew that. So I was kind of ahead of the curve, because most guys were, you know, still on aligning tape machines, and I was learning how to sample with a Wendell or, you know, various things. And that allowed me to work with a lot of cool artists through John. And I think that was the beginning of the future, because that's when he had one of the first project studios, I remember, and owned his own gear and things like this. And then that led me to other opportunities. So like when I originally met Trevor Horn and Seal, well, actually through Seal, I met Trevor Horn. By me knowing a Euphonics console, he hired me, because he didn't know anybody in LA who could run a Euphonics. So my point is, I was using technology as a crutch.
What was it like working for Trevor? His records are just fabulous, and there are so many people that look up to him as, you know, yeah, the leader that he was in, you know, shaping, you know, the sound of the 80s. So it must have been cool to work for him.
It was great. I was really fortunate. When I think about my mentors, like Susan Rogers is one of them, and I think Trevor Horn would be one, where, you know, if you go back in time, he's got to be in the top five of all-time record producers, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Not only of successful records, but just you hear a record that he did and you would know it.
Yeah.
Just like other producers. And that's the problem with today's world. It's not as easy to identify. Yes, one could say the producer is the artist, but you don't, like, you would hear a Trevor Horn record and you would just like pull over in your car. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, what the hell is this? And with Trevor, it was great, because I think back of making a lot of records with him, and it was in the recording is where the magic happened, not the mixing.
Wow.
Where there was a time, as you know, Bobby, where it was like we fixed in the mix, or it'll come together in the mix. And with Trevor, it did. You did the work in the recording, which at the time wasn't fashionable. At the time, it was like just record, and we'll set it out later. But you could pull up those tracks, and they just were great. So it was. I was lucky to learn a lot from him, and surround myself around a lot of great musicians too during that time.
What was it? The players that he used?
That had a lot to do with it. He was very good about selecting good players. We were also, you know, that was when I really learned a lot more about bass. Like, for instance, like, well, what kind of bass? You know, is it real bass? And if it's real bass, is it 4-string, 5-string, round, loud, you know, different strings? You know, is it Rhodes? Is it Wurlitzer? Is it piano? Is it, you know, instrumentation was what I took from it, which was, you know, he wouldn't be afraid to say, let's record 5 bass players playing this part, and then 5 synth, like 5 real bass, and then 5 synth bass. And he would not be afraid to edit them all together to make one performance.
Wow.
He didn't care, because this was the bass. He didn't give a shit who played it, or, I mean, I use that with respect, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that was when I started to learn more about instrumentation and editing together a performance of, it's the end result that matters, not anything else.
So it was all in the arrangement then, basically, and how the sounds laid together just to begin with, right?
Yeah, he was really good with editing, and he was really good with, I mean, in the same breath, there were plenty of times I can tell you he wasn't around.
Yeah.
And a lot of the engineers he worked with and musicians really did an awful lot of work to really help, you know, craft that sound. But at the end of the day, he was the one who would put the frame around the picture that I feel is valuable, where I'm not convinced other producers are compared to that. Like, Rick Rubin.
Mm-hmm.
But I never hear a Rick Rubin record that stops me in my tracks.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I mean, yes, and people say, oh yeah, but he's so good at picking songs or like telling you what sounds good or what doesn't sound good. But what I don't hear Rick Rubin records and go, oh my God. I mean, sorry, but I just rarely.
Yeah, but there's so few producers that can really have that magic, though. I mean, and you're right. I can remember being in the UK once, and everywhere you went, you heard Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and they're putting out a different mix every week, and people couldn't wait for the new mixes, and they would compare them, they'd argue over them, and this wasn't just the musos. This was, you know, the average person and go to a pub and there'd be people talking about Frankie Goes to Hollywood and different mixes. And, you know, when did that ever happen?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, this guy, think about, you know, Yes and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Grace Jones and ABC and Seal and you know, keep going down the list. Hit after hit, and all those records really stood on their own. It wasn't like this is the same record again with a new, you know, new vocalist or something.
Yeah,
they were all pretty different, you know. So I was very lucky to spend a good chunk of time with him in London and in here, and I learned an awful lot. So I'm very grateful for that.
What was the biggest thing that you learned?
I would probably say making records, putting the time in the recording. That was one thing that I learned, like I'd mentioned. Also, I learned a lot to depend on technology, which he really did, because he was really, like Steve Levine, like a lot of the producers back then, they really embraced technology where a lot of people were fighting it, you know, like fighting the Lindrum or fighting certain things. He really embraced it. So, yeah, I would say those two things.
But a lot of that had to do with the fact that I think the British were ahead of everybody in terms of technology and just using it for what it was. And on over here in the American side, it was somewhat different. You're right. There was kind of a backlash against all of that, and it took an awful long time till people really got their heads around it. But you were part of that, though. When you came back, you were part of pushing it forward.
Yeah, I was always, you know... And that was something that I learned. So like when I was making records in the States, in American studios, and they were like, who's this Seal guy? And like, how are you doing this to that? And it was things that I learned and I didn't care because I just, you know, a lot of people were, you know, I mean, and I'm not saying I'm a leader, but they were following trends more often than leading. And I think at that point, because technology wasn't as common as it is now, but because I knew certain technique and I knew certain instruments, I was already applying those to the record. So hopefully it was dividing me from the rest. And there was a, you know, a small window. Because I'll never forget this moment. I mean, Dave Way has had a much bigger career than me and has made a lot of money, unlike me. But I remember one time at Larrabee and I was working with Seal, and then I was just after that working with some other new artist. And, you know, I wasn't making crazy money or anything, but I was working on the coolest records, and I had a little bit of swagger. And Dave was, like, you know, working on, like, Spice Girls or something, which, hey, he was getting paid a lot of money, a lot of royalties. He was at the top of his game. But he looked at me one time when we were hanging out, and it's just like, man, how did you go from here to this is what I want to be doing, like these cool records. And I was like, yeah, but you're getting paid and I'm not, you know, but it was an interesting moment because, you know, it's like the grass always is greener on the other side. And it was really kind of humbling to know you were making a little bit of a difference in your own community where other people might've wanted to get involved, but it wasn't as easy back then because a lot of those guys were just making a lot of money, working on a lot of big hit records, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so yeah. You're working for Trevor, and then I know that you went out on your own. You mixed a lot of pretty good records, and you engineered some stuff. And then you became a producer. How did you make that transition?
How I made that transition was being visible in the local scene. And I think I always tell people the only way you're really going to make a giant leap forward as a producer is to be involved in the local scene. I don't care if you live in Madison, Wisconsin, or Hollywood. And at that time, I knew a lot of local people. And there was an A&R guy named Jamie Cohen, may he rest in peace, who was at that time went from a major, and he was heading Private Music, which was Peter Baumann from Tangerine Dream's label. And they had a deal for BMG, and they were really trying to do not new age records, but something more cutting edge. So he signed this girl, Kristen Beidhart, who was a really great singer, and she also was in the scene. So then he gave me a shot, my first shot as a producer. And here I am producing this girl's record, and we were working with the Red Hot Chili Peppers before they were big, Fishbone before they were big, Jill Jones from Prince's Camp, and Dia Davenport from Brand New Heavies, Ann Fiddler from George Clinton. And I could go down the list of a lot of people who were big in the local scene, but in the local scene, but not at a grand scale. I mean, I remember the Chili Peppers weren't really that big. So that record, of course, didn't do very well because it was a little Indian record at the time. But it put me on the map with a lot of locals, and that helped me continue to produce other artists within that circle and gain me some credibility because the record was really good.
What's interesting, though, okay, so then you go from that, and then you become an artist yourself.
That's an interesting story, yeah.
Yeah, how does one make that transition? Because, let's face it, just about everybody in the music business that's on the tech side, they started out as a musician, and a lot of people get stuck, even though they want to continue as, you know, being a creator, being a musician, they get stuck as an engineer or whatever, and they never can make that transition. How did you do it?
This is a good story. I was doing programming and stuff for other artists, and it kind of came to me that maybe I should do this on my own. And at the time, my first artist deal was on Network Records, and the project was called Povi, P-O-V-I, and I met this girl from Sydney, Australia called Christar. And I don't even remember how I met her now. I apologize. But we just did some writing and some demos, and it was really good. And somehow Network heard it, and they signed us as an artist. So this is where the story gets interesting, because Hovey kind of was a really cool record, very credible, but like a lot of records, kind of got lost. And this was like 98, 99. And then I was signed to Network still as a record producer. And they, one of the managers there was Dave Holmes. And Dave Holmes managed Coldplay. And this is a really good story. So Coldplay, when they first came out on Parlophone, the record got passed around the EMI chain in North America, and they passed. So Capitol passed. So because Network had a deal through EMI, they said, we'll take the record. It was the Parachute, the first record, the Parachutes or something. So then they needed a label manager, which was Dave Holmes. And then Dave Holmes was this kid from Vancouver or somewhere, yeah, in Canada, ended up kind of co-managing them for the U.S. side. Then the record started to take off. And then Capitol said, we want it back. So it was on Capitol. So now fast forward, I'm producing Paul Oakenfold's record, which was his big record, and engineering and mixing and writing and co-writing. And Dave Holmes is then managing me at the time. And he's like, man, you're doing all this great work for Paul. You're writing these tracks. Why don't you do another artist record? And then that convinced me to kind of go back, but then I just did it under my own name. And then it was really the KCRW, Jason Bentley and Chris Dritas, who were good friends of mine, I was lucky enough for them to like the music and play it on air and championing it, that kind of helped give me a career as a solo artist.
Was your time with Paul Oakenfold, was that where you got into electronic music?
That was when I really got into electronic music, because I was doing electronic music with Povey, but Paul was, you know, that was the big leagues, and it was a very high profile record, a lot of big artists on it. And this guy, Andy Gray, was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, who he works with. And he really helped school me in some of that stuff. And that's what really helped me get more involved.
Where is electronic music going? I know you dislike the term EDM, but it seems like, I'll just say EDM is a subgenre. It seems like that has peaked somewhat, but electronic music hasn't, right? Am I right?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I think EDM as a term has become kind of taboo because it's sort of related to kind of being cheesy or kind of Vegas bottle service music. So I think that term is diluting. There is, electronic music is still huge, as EDM is still huge as a business or as a brand, but I think there's still a big disconnect from the DJ culture and the electronic music scene. Because there's so many bridges within that it's constantly changing. You know what I mean? Like house music or techno or drum and bass or minimal or go down the list. But I think electronic music is at an all-time high of popularity because so many other artists are, you know, infusing it into their modern production and their music. But I still think that there's a big disconnect, and the DJ culture is just, it's just out of control, because I think with technology, it's so easy to DJ. Everyone is a DJ. People aren't DJing as much. It's a different kind of entertainment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's still hard to DJ. It's still hard to know how to lift a crowd, bring them up, bring them down on the fly, react immediately. But the problem is that that's a dying art. That's a lost skill.
Is it because it's saturated? The business is saturated, and like anything else, you have your leaders, and you have, you know, the cream of the crop, and then you have a lot of mediocre people, you know, especially as things get larger. And is that the case here?
I wouldn't say that it's saturated as much as it is. They make so much money, and they live in such a bubble, they're afraid to change. And it's interesting because with this job, I'm in bed with so many A-list DJs, and I see really how they do things. And it's such a business, and they're working so hard, well, or flying around. So, you know, they're constantly, you know, working 3-4 nights a week, or really 3 nights a week, DJing, and they're making so much money. It's hard for them to mix it up, because I think they're afraid that if one thing goes wrong, or if we take one chance and it goes wrong, the ship sinks. And you kind of can't blame them. I mean, like, a good example is this kid, Zed, really sweet kid from Germany, who lives in LA. He's got to be 23, 24 years old, I'm guessing. He's making $23 million a year.
Wow.
I mean, and, you know, it's not a big production, but, you know, it's a production, and it's smooth. You know, they have a routine, and I don't blame them. You know what I mean? Like, you're riding this bubble, you know, and these guys show up, you know, 20 minutes before a gig, 20 minutes. I'm talking like minutes. Setup time is seconds or minutes, and it's a 1 or 2 hour show, and then they're out. it's just crazy. And they're making so much money. I think that it's hard for them to challenge themselves when they want, or, you know, go against the grain, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Answer me this. I understand from maybe a more global perspective on, you know, the culture and the genre somewhat, but I don't know the insides of it. Are the popular DJs, are they really good creators? Are they capable of creating? Do they have chops?
Some do. It's interesting. There are definitely a lot of DJs out there, I can say, that don't make their own music, or they have very little to do with their music. They might have other skill sets. But then there are guys like Zed, which is a good example, who's a fantastic musician. He's very technical. You don't always hear it in his music, but he's the real deal in that sense. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, there's a difference, because a lot of these DJs are more performers than they, well, he's a tremendous guy, as opposed to creators.
Yeah. Who do you think are the best creators in the genre?
I mean, I'm a big fan of Trent Moeller from Copenhagen. I'm a big fan of John Hopkins from England. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Apparat from Berlin. I'm generally into a lot of the darker electronic stuff. Mm-hmm. All those guys are really good musicians as well. All those guys make great albums. They also DJ, but they play live. They all fall into that kind of hybrid where they can play with the band, or they can DJ, or they can do a little bit of both together. They put on a good show. I don't generally, but I mean, you know, I don't want to take away from the DJ culture either, because there is something to be said about, you know, going on a journey with a DJ, but it's just, I don't see that enough.
Where do you see electronic music going? Is there a trend that's happening now that's taking it somewhere?
I think what the trend is, well, that's really hard to predict, but if I can say, I think people want to perform more electronically. And I think that because they know that the public knows that it's pretty easy with technology to not do a lot, I think that they want to prove to the audience that they're doing something. So I think that you're going to see performance come out more in electronic music, whether it's incorporating more technology so they're doing something, or whether it's having more musicians up there, or whether it's GoPro cameras showing them that they're doing something, because it's sort of a joke of certain DJs that they're not doing a lot. But I just want to make it clear too, though, it's okay if you're not doing something up there either. You know what I mean? There's plenty of people, you know, doing a whole lot up there, and it still sucks, because even if you're playing two tracks, it still takes a talent, like I said, to work the crowd. But I just think that's something in the future I feel people are going to sort of gravitate to.
I'd like to see that myself. And I have to say, every time I watch something on television where the live from Ibiza or something like that, I just find it terribly boring to watch somebody, you know, doing that. And there's no performance really. And the biggest performance is someone getting, you know, behind clapping, you know, and trying to get the crowd clapping with them. And I understand it's different when you're there. It's the whole vibe, but it doesn't translate to video very well.
Well, and that's a good point that you bring up, you know, Bobby, because I think a lot of this is fashion. And that's something, you know, I talked about a little bit. I did a TED Talk a couple years ago, and that was something that I talked about, which is, for instance, a Coachella, for instance, it gets sold out before they even announce the lineup.
Yeah.
Because it's fashion, it's a lifestyle. And a lot of the music, you'll say like, oh my God, I'm going to go see Carl Cox play tonight. It's going to be fantastic. When in fact, it's just being there and you're in the lights and it's loud and it's crowded and you have a few drinks, or in some cases, these kids might be high or whatever they're doing, or you're with your girlfriend, boyfriend. It's the moment. And, you know, as opposed to watching it on video or listening to it in your car. And I think so much of it is the moment. And I think that has a lot to do with it, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, you know, it's just like my son who goes to Coachella every year, you know, he's that kid who's there at 12 noon as opposed to showing up at 4 or 5 in the afternoon because he wants to take it in. He wants to discover an artist under the tent, in the sun, you know, which is kind of endearing in one way, if that works. But it's just interesting how, which is a whole other, I think, conversation of music festivals, how much they charge and how they sell out before they even announce who's playing.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. You know, I want to switch subjects for a little bit here. I was looking at your website before and I saw that you were doing a lot of remixes. And I'm just wondering, do you have a specific approach when you remix? Is it something that you have a predetermined way of doing, or is it unique for every artist or every song?
I'd like to think that I have a style for remixing. I think the remix world is so saturated and so different than it used to be. Nobody gets paid very well for remixes. Names don't matter anymore. Like back in the day, you needed a big name. It's almost the opposite. It's almost to your benefit if it's not a big name sometimes. And it's also, people don't care. Like, especially like radio DJs or club DJs, they almost would prefer that it's undiscovered. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. In the sense of remixing, I always tell people, I do my best work when I don't have any limitations for remix. Like if you say I want a club remix, there's plenty of people that'll do that better for me. I said, what I do is I give you a different version of your song. And generally, it's more radio friendly, but more specialty radio friendly, i.e. a KCRW NPR style station, because I said, that's something that I feel I can give you because one, it has my name attached to it. Two, it will hopefully open up some more opportunities for you. For instance, like, you know, some sync licensing or, you know, KCRW style. So that's usually how I approach the stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I see that also you've been doing a lot of traveling. Are you doing gigs when you're traveling, or are these speaking engagements? Or
It's both. I mean, I would say since I've taken this job, it's been more, you know, speaking or like, you know, in the last little bit, like just a couple of months, like, you know, went to music conference was, you know, for NI, South by Southwest was the same thing. I spoke at MuTech in Montreal. I spoke at EDM Biz in Vegas. But then, you know, I do try, you know, last couple of gigs for traveling, well, I guess Palm Springs, Dubai. I haven't been traveling as much for gigs just because I haven't. And I retired from my NEOS project, which is, was a very successful band, a world music electronic project that I've been doing for 10 years, and I just got burned out, so I stopped. And I did a lot of touring with them.
Yeah, I know. That was a big pet project of yours, for sure.
It was a really pet project, and it was very successful, and it really gave me a lot of credibility in the world music scene, which I have a great passion for. But I just got burned out, and after 10 years, I was like, I need to move on. So when my own music that I'm making is my own stuff has become more ambient, which I prefer. I really like doing ambient music.
Mm-hmm.
And then, my and a lot of the production stuff is more world music, which I feel that I've been known to do this sort of hybrid of tasteful electronic and sort of Middle Eastern world music stuff. So I'm producing a project at the moment that I'm almost finished with for someone. And then my next project, my solo project, is going to be sort of under a different name. That's going to be a little bit of a ethnic style project because I really enjoy it. I really do enjoy it.
Being a producer is way different these days, isn't it? Than the way it used to be.
It just is. I mean, I just feel like we just don't have a business anymore. But it's funny, Bobby, because I'm seeing in this job, because this is really interesting to me, this work, because you either see guys, you know, our age or whatever that, you know, have had success but are struggling or are finding other ways to make money or whatever the case may be, or there's just no middle ground. Or you see these young kids who are just blowing up.
Yeah.
Who it's just, but to me, I look at it as inspiring. Not all of the cases, but a lot of the cases. Like, for instance, I have a meeting actually in about 10 or 15 minutes with this kid, Joe Kay, who I don't know if you've heard of Joe Kay, but he has a collective called Selection.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been grooming him, and he's the nicest, most humble kid. And he now has a primetime radio show on Apple on Saturday night at 9 o'clock. The kid turned down a residency at Nokia, Club Nokia, to do it at the Regent downtown, which holds like 1,200 to 1,500 people. And he sells out every time they play.
Wow.
And he has this collective of just, he has a radio show every week that he gives away, and he doesn't sell the record. He gives the stuff away on SoundCloud, and the guy is touring the world. It's just, it's this new model, but it's just really inspiring. And especially, you know, how he's branded himself and the collective called Selection. It's interesting. So it's funny because the record business as it was just, I think will never be.
Well, you know, that kind of proves the point. I've been saying this in some of my books in music 3.0 and 4.0 books for a long time. Your music is your marketing these days. And actually it always has been really, because you gave it away for free, basically on the radio for years and hoping people would come to your gigs and buy your merch and all that stuff. Only it wasn't as obvious as it is today that that's an income source, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I always tell people, it's not about selling records. It's about getting your music heard.
Yeah.
Don't even worry about selling it. It's just getting it heard. And then hopefully that leads to other opportunities, whether it's, you know, whatever that might be, work for hire. I mean, it's very humbling, you know, I mean, it's very humbling. I mean, it's been humbling for me in this kind of job because, you know, I don't really talk about my history or credentials or Grammy nominations or blah, 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 blah. But then, you know, it almost means nothing. And it's just interesting. I don't know where it's all going because I just try to keep a level head.
Yeah, it's all changing, that's for sure. Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice, music business advice, that you've either learned through your career or someone imparted to you?
Two things, not in this order, but I would say don't base your career on money, but base it on the music you make. I always tell young people, no one checks your bank account. No one asks you how much money you made on this project. They say, you made that record or you were a part of that project. And that's something you need to hang your hat on, because some of my best work or biggest work or the work I'm most proud of was never the highest paying. So that's one bit of advice. Too many people ruin relationships based on money. Another thing is social skills. I think it's something completely underrated, where I've spoken a lot at schools, and only one school that I'm aware of, which is Full Sail, grade you on social skills, because I say you'll graduate from these schools, and hopefully you're all pretty sharp and knowledgeable. But then your social skills have to kick in.
Yeah.
And I give this example all the time of, like, over the years, I've had many assistants or interns, and that's where trust comes in social skills. I've had Chris Martin at my studio. I've had Pete Townsend. I've had Steele, put on the list, Billy Corgan, et cetera. If I can't trust that person in the room, or that person smells, or that person's wearing flip-flops and shorts every day and doesn't reflect me, that's a problem. And I think that some of these kids have often a chip on their shoulder and this sort of safety net of, like, they have too much swagger. And I just feel that at the end of the day, you look at two, three people in the room, they're all talented, but who do you want to be around all day?
Yeah, right.
And I think that's often, I mean, I can tell you people that are more talented than me, I might get the gig. And sometimes I think, well, maybe because they like me more. I don't know.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And we both know really talented engineers and producers and musicians that aren't working today because of their personality. And when they're hot, when they're really hot, of course they work all the time, but at a certain point that goes away. And then, as you say, your personality has to kick in.
Well, and I think honestly, I mean, I'll kind of end it with this, where, you know, for so many years I was involved with NARIS, with the Grammys and trustee and governor. And I wrote categories and technical Grammys, like, I got on the list. And that advisory board was so, it was such a bunch of dinosaurs and horse shit. And I mean that with respect, actually, because there were so many wonderful people in that room and legends in that room and people that could do so much. But it was saddening to me that we all couldn't be honest with each other all the time. And it really bummed me out. And it came to a point where there were so many smoke and mirrors that I ended up, you know, resigning. I was the only person that turned my chair in. I said, I don't want to be involved.
Yeah.
And they were almost offended.
Yeah.
Because, like, what would happen is we'd be talking about things that were just irrelevant, insignificant, like track sheets. Like, who the fuck makes a track sheet anymore?
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about reality. I mean, this is, you know, cut to the chase. Or, like, somebody was doing, like, a Japanese record, and they were too embarrassed to say. And it's like, no, you should be able to just say, hey, man, I'm just happy I'm working this month, and I'm making a Japanese record. Well, good for you. You're mastering your craft or something. And nobody would be, it would be difficult for them because they've had, you know, they were big shots. And, it was just a little bit disappointing to me. And I think that goes back to social skills of just honesty with people, you know?
Oh, you and I can have some really good conversations just on that, I'm sure.
Yeah, because, you know, it's okay, you know? I mean, it's okay to say, you know, I'm struggling or I'm not working as much. I mean, this is a community of people that we hope we can help each other. And there's just often so many smoke and mirrors up. And I know it's not easy and I know it's embarrassing at times, but this is our world, Bobby. I mean, this is our colleagues. Like, I ran into Al Schmidt yesterday or Monday, and it was great to see him and it was great to embrace him. And, you know, there are people that you want to just talk about certain things and not be afraid.
Yeah. Right. Right. You definitely. Know. Carmen, thanks so much for your time today. This has been great.
No, Bobby, thanks. I hope I give you good information. And again, man, I really have to say, I love your newsletters and your tweets and all of the above. And they're all valuable because like I said, we started so often, people who do that, it's just horse shit. But I gain a lot of knowledge from your site, and whatever I can do to help to promote that or anything, it really is good.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. That's awesome of you to say that. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
To find out more about Carmen, you can go to carmenrizzo.com. That's CarmenRizzo.com. Carmen Rizzo, all one word. And there's lots of information, a nice discography, and a nice bio, and a lot of info about what he's doing now. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.